Welcome to the Plant Spirit Podcast on connecting with plant consciousness and the healing wisdom of nature. I'm your host, Sarah Artemisia, and I'm delighted and deeply honored to introduce our next guest to the show today. Chris Hardy is the owner and lead grower at Hardy Seeds, and he's been challenging the paradigm of modern agriculture since he began farming over 20 years ago. In 2015, Chris founded Hardy Seeds to continue the work his grandfather inspired, and he now oversees an extensive collection of heritage grains, legumes, herbs, and vegetable seeds. Chris was the initiator of the historic campaign in Southern Oregon to ban genetically engineered GMO crops to protect traditional seeds from the threat of contamination. And he serves on several nonprofit boards and associations committed to actively supporting seed diversity and small farm resilience. His extensive travels abroad have kept his passion high for cultural diversity, regenerative farming, and community engagement. So Chris, thank you so much for being here. You have such a wealth of wisdom and deep commitment and passion to the seeds in this life. And I'm so grateful for your life's work and for you joining us here today. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you. Great to be here, Sarah. Thank you so much.
So awesome to connect about this. And you know, we were talking earlier about the experience of being in relationship with plants and how this is so important. And when it comes to growing food, certainly working with regenerative practices that honor the cycles and connections with nature are such a huge part of this. And I know that this is a huge part of what you are doing at the farm. And so I'm curious if you could tell us a bit about these regenerative methods and farming practices that you work with on the farm.
Sure. Yeah. We grow a lot of pollinator plants. We have a lot of pollinator hedges. That really kind of helps anchor in our boundaries, and it also helps support our pollinators that are so important for the seeds that we grow. We're also incorporating a lot of heritage grains. We grow over 100 varieties of heritage grains from places like Syria, Pakistan, Ethiopia, Iraq, Afghanistan, Kazakhstan, Georgia and Armenia, places in the Caucasus where grains, many of these grains originated thousands and thousands of years ago, parts of Turkey, places where I've traveled and spent a lot of time on multiple trips abroad, doing the work to reduce the amount of tillage that we do on our land. And just making sure there's living roots in the soil at all time and covering the soil. It's all a part of our project with our grains moving towards having more carbon put back in the soil from these grains that are deeper rooted and more resilient to climate and to drought that we have been witnessing here over the past several years or more, that we've kind of been in a drought cycle, and a 1200 year drought to be exact, the Pacific Northwest is experiencing. So we're just having to just kind of up the game on the amount of mulching that we do and the diversity of cropping, because it's so important. Because if we don't have that diversity of crops, then we're just kind of to the throes of whatever the pest issues, the drought issues, the weather. We've had hailstorms and things that have come and wiped out a bunch of our crops in past years. And so it's good just not to put all our eggs in one basket and do like how most people think about feeding the world. It's like, it's important for a farm operation to be viable, to have a lot of diversity in there. Not only for the sake of the pollinators and the diversity of native pollinators that do upwards of 70% of all pollination of our food, of our native endemic plants that are up in the hills and the wildlands that are all around us here in the mountains of Southern Oregon And everywhere in the world, they say 70% of all pollination is due to those native pollinators. But we know that the soil microbes rely on that same concept of diversity. And without that diversity above the soil and below the soil, we're in trouble, because that's when those pests that rely on like monocrops, they get out of hand. And that's when you then say, oh, well, where's our pesticide? Here's our toolbox. And, you know, right now that model of agriculture is collapsing, and it's convenience-based. It's quick fix of even organic. It's a quick fix of fertilizer, you know, organic chicken pellets. Now they come in pellets. They come in 50-pound bags. You can get that anywhere in the United States. And that's just a quick fix. Throw it down, get the nitrates, get the minerals, the nutrients in there. And we're trying to be on the front line of finding a different way to do this. So we put our plants through a lot more rigors of selecting for the most resilient plants without all those heavy inputs that we're seeing so many other operations. Even my mentors are doing this right now, and it's because they got to have a viable farm operation, and the current seed system is built upon that mindset. And so we're trying to change that mindset to where we're using less inputs for our food system.
Yeah, there's so much in what you were just sharing there, certainly alluding to, well, you even said it, that our current farming system is in the state of collapse, that we're currently witnessing that, and that the diversity of crops is so important. It's so key, that it's a very key component to really working with this and supporting us to have sustainable food sources in the future. And I'm curious, because you really are on the front lines of working with diverse seed saving, and I know you do a lot of trials with different varietals and things like this, I'm curious, what is your vision for a diverse, like, what would work? What do you think could work, even just say in this country or even worldwide? What would make that work for us to really move through, yeah, what many people are calling the extinction bottleneck that we're currently going through on this planet, to really thrive and come through on the other side in a way where we are all feeling nourished and supported and in a good way with our food sources?
Yeah, boy, there's a lot in there. There's a lot of work. And I think a lot of the work has to come from inside. When we think about our food, I feel like it's time to reinvent what we have known and have called our food for some of us for generations, for decades, you know, like our lives. And some of us have been around a little longer and can actually still remember back to those days where food was food. Organic was just food. And now many years later, we have to have this label, the label certified organic. It has to be stamped that. Otherwise, it's like maybe got some bad stuff in it that we don't want to put a lot of in our bodies. And I think it's about asking, what kind of culture do we want to bring forward as farmers into, for our children to be brought up on? Because if our children are being brought up on a more whole food idea and practice and culture, because we can say culture, because like it's really a metaphor to the culture of the pro-life, probiotic, like you want diversity in there. And so if you think of like a fermentation of like taking a cabbage and just chopping it up and, you know, and letting it ferment for a few weeks, and then now you're eating fresh sauerkraut, it's like loaded with all this diversity of all these microbes. And it's like, we can be doing that every step of the way if we think in terms of like, well, how does Mother Nature do her deal. Like, how does she get by? Oh, she's just this big old soup of all this diversity. And without that diversity, it's kind of getting by. It's mostly just kind of, it's hobbling on one. It's at one piston. It's like, instead of all these pistons going and, you know, it's efficient. It's just kind of like getting by on, yeah, it's hobbling around on one leg instead of being like healthy and having a good flow. So we really need to look at how we can incorporate diversity at every turn. And that means diversity of voices in farming. That means diversity of practices. That means diversity of seeds, first and foremost. And those seeds carry with them culture. They carry with them opportunity. They carry with them a potential, this potential to do something really cool. And I really love the metaphor of like how fruits and vegetables, that now they're saying that like every apple, for instance, is just like loaded with bacteria. Bacteria, like, wait, what? Even after I wash it, it's kind of like in the peeling of the apple. And we put that in our body and it's probiotic or prebiotic and probiotic. It's like, it's this perfect fruit, that the apple. And it just goes on with the plums and the pears and the grapes and the frijoa and the just every one of these different fruits and vegetables that are out there. It's like there's so many different merits, like kiwi, you know. It's like, do you peel the kiwi or not peel the kiwi? You know, it's like, boy, maybe there's a function, like thinking whole food, there's a function for the skin that we should be consuming more of the whole fruit. Places where I've traveled, like Kyrgyzstan in Central Asia, Uzbekistan, Pakistan, they don't really have almond trees there. They have apricots, the Hunza apricots, the Ladakhi apricots, the places. And so they take the nut out of those and crack that nut. And then that's a secondary fruit. You don't nut the meat. It's high protein. It's high in important fats. But we like to process things and take out all the good. And it's like, oh, well, this will help the storage life. This will help the shipability. This will help commoditize our food system. And it's like, boy, that's just the backwards direction we're headed. As we know now, you know, we've got so many sick people. They say the life expectancy in America is dropping for the first time ever. We're now like, it appears to be we're on the way down. We're like doing something wrong. And that's because something like 30% of children by 2030 will be clinically obese. 1 in 3 children. Like, wait, how could our kids are supposed to be active and eating healthy whole foods, but instead they're eating more processed foods and they're more digital devices and video games and computers and all this stuff. Or it's just changing a lifestyle and making more disconnection instead of getting them out to be with these natural elements, to actually breathe in this outside air instead of being protected from breathing in. It's like we're just not meant to be so segregated from all of these things.
Yeah, that thing that you brought up earlier, which I love, that query of how would nature do it? That is something, my life query, that is my life motto, this question of how would nature do it? No matter what situation I'm in, I can ask that question and that will give me, that will reveal the answer if I sit and listen long enough, which is amazing that you brought that up too. And just how would nature do it with being alive as a human in this world, connecting with the many various life forms that we exist with and are in relationship with on this planet. And I love too, how you were talking earlier about your experience of traveling and connecting with these ancient diverse grains around the world. And I was curious to hear a bit more about that. How have international travels really impacted your work with plants and seeds? Because that seems like a very unique and special aspect to me of the way that you work with seeds.
Yeah. Back to my earliest travels, my first travels, that would have been like Italy, like Sicily, in mainland Italy. And at that time, I mean, my mom, you know, she, the family, we, grandma and grandpa, they were all organic farmer and an organic gardener. And I mean, they all, even the organic farmer, my grandma and grandpa in the other part of Iowa, a huge garden, and they fed 11 kids. They had 11 children who were helping on the farm. Catholic family, classic Catholic family. It just, and they did such an amazing job of raising their kids on these healthy foods. But I went to Italy leaving school, and like we kind of got a little bit away from that. But when I went to Italy, I was like, wow, this food is like, it is of the gods. It is so nutrient dense and just like everything that I remembered when I was the youngest as a kid. And that just blew my mind. The bread was so wholesome and so like chewy, and just sourdoughs that they made every day in the bakeries. There were bakeries everywhere, and you got all these different kinds of breads and the olives and even apricots there in Italy. I remember riding my bike through the countryside in Sicily, just roadside, picking blood oranges that just the flavor I've never to this day tasted such amazingness. But maybe of Sicily, you know, it's so volcanic from Mount Etna that it's a volcanic island. And so it's just very mineral rich. And the only thing I could think is the terroir of Sicily. It just, the calzones made of the fresh bread and the fresh mozzarella di bufala, and then the basil and the tomatoes and the olives, the olive oil. Oh my God. Like it just was so off the chart rich. And so anyhow, traveling onward through Asia, through Southeast Asia, through Central Asia and the Indian subcontinent, the Pacific Rim, most of my travels have been there, and also in South America and some countries there. And they just cherish food so much. And, you know, maybe it's because not only because they're just more connected to the earth, but they're more connected culturally to like, wow, this is who I am. And they're not like a bag of Doritos. Every, you know, every street corner, you got like a 7-Eleven and whatever, you run in and grab convenience food and stuff. They just don't have that. But they give 30, they pay 30, 40, 50% of their income if they're not subsistent, where they just have it coming out of the field. Their 30, 40, 50% of everything that they earn goes into putting groceries on the table. So it's like they, there's just so many reasons why they have a deeper appreciation for their food. It's, but culturally, just can't, they can't. It's been a part of their culture for thousands of years. Places in Turkey where I traveled. Yeah, I just think of just so many examples that are popping in my brain right now of why this fruit was best tasting in Azerbaijan, why the pomegranates, or Armenia, why the cheese in Armenia, you know, the sheep, that they make sheep cheese. So it's fresh every day and it's available on every street corner.
Yeah, amazing. And having witnessed all that, because clearly that has impacted you so much, how do you see those experiences that you've had worldwide really coming through in your work with seeds and growing food?
So we have to get these seeds into gardeners' hands. Absolutely. Because that is a part of that shifting of the culture. Because once everybody has these growing in their gardens, and then they're sharing these fruits with the gardener next door, their neighbor who's growing these in their gardens, and this exchange is really where the magic is at. Because it, let's say things got really tough and we're having to rely on our farmers more, it is the consumer that is going to drive the choices of what the farmer is going to grow. Because if the farmer is like, well, I could grow this type of lettuce or I could grow that type of lettuce, it's like, some of these really amazing heirloom butter lettuces that are just, like the oils on your tongue are just like, you can just feel the oil in your mouth. You know, vegetable oil comes from vegetables, in some cases, lettuce, and they extract that out of these vegetables. Of course, anymore that nowadays vegetable oil is so adulterated with just, I think they make it from canola and it's like a blend of vegetables. But just to know that you're getting those components, those oils that are so good for your body. But it's just that experience of eating is really going to be the big change that's really going to drive our culture in a different direction. And again, forming little communities and little neighborhoods everywhere. I think that is the change. And that gets the conversation of, where did you get those seeds? Oh, those have been grown in, they came from New England and they were grown there for decades. And before that, we lost track because, you know, maybe it was the natives or maybe it came over from Europe. That has some cultural significance. And once we start incorporating these things into our diet and the stories get out there about that, I think that's where people are going to be asking, where do we get those seeds from? And that's where I believe, and hopefully we have seed savers on every street corner that are doing that with those vegetables that they're growing. And then we don't have to like have a bunch of seed companies that are trying to get the seeds out to people. It's like, oh yeah, well, I heard about your seed company. It's like, no, how about you just save those seeds? And then we don't have to, like how it is these days, most people go on the internet to get their seeds. And that's another potential for disconnect. And we don't want to see all that type of stuff get in the way.
Yeah, totally. You just talked about this vision, this dream of really there being seed savers on every street corner. And clearly you work a ton with the heritage greens and crops. And so I'm curious, for folks who are really interested in taking this a step further, you know, listening to you, your wise words of advice here for next steps as we move forward with our food staples, could you tell us a bit more about the Heritage Grain Seed Library and how people can really get involved with it?
Yeah. So at this point, we've been working on the seed library for 3 years. It began as a project in partnership with the Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance. And they had this vision of increasing access to heirloom and heritage grains, again, of which are more climate resilient, are more rich with nutrients and minerals and vitamins, and less about the starch, if you will, and the sugar, and more about, what do they say, the beef. Where's the beef? You know, it's like, it's just more nutrient density there. And so you're like really getting some substance there with these heritage grains. So we set down that path of trying to help Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance out. And the seed movement increased access to these seeds. But as soon as we set off on that journey, we realized that our local community is in the same boat. And I'm like right here in our local community, and I've worked with farmers in this valley for more than 15 years. And I was like, man, I can meet and connect with farmers. I can go to farmers' lands. I can help farmers understand how to process their seeds here locally. We have equipment here locally that we can share between growers that can help us process and winnow and thresh these seeds. We're designing right now, a friend of mine is helping design a thresher. He's an engineer, and he's like coming up with this thresher that's going to help us process a lot of grains and legumes. And these, again, are the commodities that are so commonly just, oh, we'll let somebody else grow that. I've been farming for more than 20 years, and this is what I've heard over and over and over for years. And now here we are at apparently what is the time to just make this happen. And so we're doing it to actually just say it's that important. We've lost 94% of all seeds that feed humanity on this planet. 94% of those genetics have been lost to the industrial-based, commoditized food model. And that doesn't matter if you're in India. It doesn't matter if you're in Ukraine. That's the reality of the global food system. So right now, it's time to pick up the game. And if we're going to be more resilient in the face of climate, with these changes that we're seeing happen and hearing happen all over the world right now, we're going to have to do something. And so that's what this seed library in Southern Oregon, the grain and bean seed library, is just to make these more available to people first and foremost here locally. And we're excited with the dozen plus partners that we have been working with to help us. Now we're on multiple acres and taking, Sarah, what was a tablespoon of seed, and we're looking forward to a yield in the thousands of pounds here this year in 2022.
Incredible. That reminds me of that quote. I think it's something to the effect of 1,000 forests are born from one acorn or something like that. Just how powerful this potential of the seeds really are when we put that into action. Mm-hmm. And you know, you mentioned earlier how you've been farming for over 20 years. I'd love to hear a bit more about that. You know, how did you even get involved in farming in the first place? And what's your journey been with the plants over the years?
Yeah, so, oh man, the journey with the plants. I guess, again, it just kind of started in Iowa. And I got to see my grandma and grandpa's garden. Grandpa was really the master gardener, and grandma would take the veggies and can and ferment and do all these amazing fermented foods. And she would make her own bread. But I guess it was pretty much just the connection with seeing how much care and love they put into this amazing garden, and my mother and father, an amazing garden, mostly my mom on that side, because dad was always working. Had a painting business. But when it came to potato harvest and came to sweet potatoes and tomatoes, like, you know, it would require all of us kids to be out there in the field. Granddad would bring his tractor, the organic gardener, a master gardener, Grandpa Hardy would bring his garden tractor, and it had a plow on it. And it was just a riding lawnmower with this plow connected. And it would just flip the potatoes all out because he hit it just right. And he knew exactly like how to get the potatoes out, but it would flip all the potatoes out. And us kids would go out there just picking potatoes. And then the other connection that I have with plants is working on my grandfather's farm of my mother's side. And that was on the Wisconsin, Illinois, the Mississippi Riverside, out looking over the Mississippi Basin and in Iowa, on the other side of Iowa. And I would help go out there in the summer and help put up alfalfa hay and would help harvest corn. And he grew barley and oats and wheat and rye, I believe, and some legume. Oh, and alfalfa. But just helping tend the animals on their 300-acre farm. And back when this was like a real family farm, like a real organic, diverse family farm, not like, oh, yeah, we have this beautiful family farm and we grow corn. And there's nothing wrong with that. But just saying, like, when you start to add and see, like, the richness that diversity brings into a farm, that's when I really started learning about all these different plants and going mushroom hunting and wild foraging for huckleberries and raspberries and things out in the woods. I'd say that was like the earliest experiences that I remember with plants. And then my international travels and after that, and then starting a farm in Bozeman, Montana, where I delivered by bike to restaurants. fresh cut greens, and those would go direct to restaurants. And then I eventually started selling to the Bozeman Community Food Co-op. And then I kind of graduated from being able to run bags of greens to restaurants on my bicycle to carrying hundreds of pounds of produce in my truck to the co-op. And I was doing that twice a week, and they just couldn't get enough. And I, on my brother's backyard, just my brother's backyard alone, I leased multiple plots of land in the city of Bozeman, Montana. But just in my brother's backyard alone, like a 2,700 square foot little tiny backyard, I made $10,000. And that's when I was just like, I was rocking it back then on local produce and doing less on seed saving, but more about just growing food.
I love that. Yeah. And clearly it's been such a lifelong journey, deeply connected with the plants, and particularly the food plants, the food crops, every step of the way, it sounds like. And I'd love to hear a bit about what are some fun seed crops that you're growing right now that you're really excited about.
Ooh, man, there's so many. I just cherish so much the varieties that we're growing, and I'm just getting just more and more. The thing with seeds and getting people excited about seeds, we live in a distracted world. We live in a place that is just the internet and the hype and the YouTubes and like all these different things are just, they keep our brains. Oh, what about this? Oh, what about this? You know, we're just like all over the map. And so that kind of, with that comes this need for seed companies to keep kind of churning out a lot of like cool things and, oh, we got this. Oh, you should try that. You know, yes, they maybe taste different. Do they taste better? I don't know. Maybe you've been growing this one thing for 10 years and it's kind of just boring. And so you're like, you found this new thing and you're like, oh, these carrots are just the best carrots. That is possible. And I'm just finding myself over these recent years, especially like, oh man, this variety right here of amaranth, the Guatemalan amaranth that we received from a friend who has a seed cooperative down in Guatemala. And she sent us this seed, and I just find it like that we can do so much with it. We can eat the greens. We can use the plant as a dye, and we can grow it on further to produce grain. And that grain, amaranth, has as much protein as quinoa. And quinoa is like, you know, they praise quinoa and they're like, oh, there's the highest protein grain. It's like, well, amaranth and quinoa are cousins. And it's so drought tolerant, so drought resistant, requires such little water to produce, and it's very resource resilient. So it doesn't need to like be pumped up with fertilizer, unlike corn. So amaranth is one, and millet is another. It is very, very, very drought tolerant, has very deep tap roots. And it's so rich in protein and nutrients for you. And some of these grains are just like rocking my world right now, Sarah. I like the purples in some of the wheat and the barley are just so violet. They're more than violet. They're like, they're just so deep purple. And those anthocyanins are, yeah, anti-cancer. And we grow a corn that has a deep purple in it too. So, but on the other hand, corn needs water. And these grains need no water, no fertilizer, no inputs, no nothing. You just plant them in the fall and maybe do a weeding in the spring, you know, as things start to green up. And we put mulch down and we're starting to accumulate more mulch over the years of growing these grains. And so we're starting to use the mulch that we produced the year previous to mulch these grains in. So we're like trying to close all the loops on our farm and not have to import and bring in, so that these grains are feeding the soil with their deep, deep tap roots, and not tap roots, but they're, you know, they go down feet to be able to, in drought. Like last year, we had epic drought, like terrible, terrible drought. We got amazing yield comparable to the year that we got all the rain. And so the rains and the snows fall and they water these grains and they just keep growing all winter long. And by the time spring sets in, ready to set seeds and they do their thing. And it's like, wow, we just got a yield out. We didn't have to set up drip lines or figure out how to water or fertilize or nothing on it. The cool weather, we call them cool weather grains because they're planted in the fall. And so unlike the sorghum and the millet and the quinoa, I really appreciate this quinoa that we've been growing in Southern Oregon since 2008. And it's been through some of the hottest weather. We had 116 degrees last year, 116 degrees in Southern Oregon. And the quinoa had an epic yield. We had an epic yield of quinoa. It was flowering right through the hottest days of the summer. We've been growing it and adapting it to Southern Oregon. It's like, people have told me over the years, like, no, what are you doing? You can't really grow quinoa in Southern Oregon because it's too hot down there. And by the way, that's supposed to be grown up in the mountains, like down in Bolivia and, you know, places where I saw it growing down in Bolivia and Peru. But I was like, man, I want to try that out in our area in Southern Oregon. And it's totally worked. And so I'm pretty excited about the quinoa too.
Amazing. Yeah. And just the power of these super resilient food crops, these super resilient food plants, that it is really important and definitely to our benefit to continue to work with them, be in relationship with them, witness them over the span of multiple years, like you've been doing. And I love that you brought up the amaranth too. Personally, amaranth is something that I've been eating my whole life. And I remember growing up eating amaranth flakes and reading the back of the cereal box and learning about how amaranth was a sacred grain of the Aztecs. And more recently was learning about how it was a really important and powerful crop of the Guatemalan resistance, that during that entire time in Guatemala, that peasant farmers would hide their amaranth seeds in glass jars, tuck it up in the rafters of their homes and bury it in their backyards, because they knew there would come a time where they would be able to grow this incredibly powerful, nourishing food crop again. And so that, which connects to me, this aspect of the value and importance of the story of seeds. I know for myself, learning that, I think I was maybe 5 or 8 or something when I learned that about the amaranth. And that as a result of that, I have felt connected with amaranth my entire life. Every time I see amaranth in person, there's this sense of like, we know each other. I see you. Amaranth sees me. We know each other. We see each other. And that, just like with people, with our human relationships, that to have this understanding of the story of the plants, of the story of the foods that we're eating is so important. And, you know, you were talking earlier about how that shift in our food system, it needs to come from within. It needs to come from the folks who are buying the foods, who are buying the seeds, that this understanding of, well, who is this plant? You know, where did you come from? What is your lineage, plant? You know, how have you been surviving and moving and thriving and being in connection and culture and community all these many millennia? Tell us, you know, what is your story? That this is such a huge part of it. And I love that you work with the seeds in that way and just have gone to all these places all over the world, connected with them in the places where they've been grown for thousands and thousands of years, and brought them to continue to work and cultivate and learn how they can really, that we can work together in collaboration in this time where we need to find these more drought tolerant crops, that this is going to be really, really, really important. It already is starting to be. And so I love that you're doing that. And, you know, I think another thing that you have done that really absolutely we need to talk about in this conversation is your work with pioneering the banning of GMO crops in Southern Oregon, because this has allowed for these seed varietals to even take place because they're not being influenced by the GMO crops, and particularly those that are wind pollinated. And so I would love to hear, nutshell, if you can, what was your experience with banning GMO crops in Southern Oregon? And for people who are really interested in doing the same in their local areas, because that is very unique, particularly in this country, to have an entire county, or between us and Josephine County and the work that Don Tipping and many other people did as well for this region, that there are others who may be interested in doing the same. And so if you have any tips for folks who are interested in pioneering that in their own local areas, what would you recommend?
Yeah, so it was 2012 when I walked into a field of genetically engineered sugar beets that were being grown right here in the town that I live in Southern Oregon, in Ashland, Oregon. And Syngenta, the Swiss multinational who was producing those GMO crops, I called up the company. They gave me the contact, the local contact of their manager. This individual told me that Syngenta was using 25 different pesticides and chemicals in their production of, in the experimentation of these GMO crops. They also told me that there were more than 30, 35 or 36 different plots that were being grown all across Jackson County and into Josephine County, basically the entire Rogue Valley, that this was going on. And I called a meeting together and sounded the alarm and notified farmers. Farmers, we had a meeting. There were about 50 farmers and concerned citizens from all across Southern Oregon that showed up at this meeting. And we decided that we needed to take action in Southern Oregon to ban genetically engineered crops, because at that time, the USDA required a 4-mile isolation distance between any non-GMO or just a regular grower that was saving seeds and Syngenta, who was doing these test plots, because at the time, sugar beets were regulated status by the USDA APHIS, the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service. And so if you understand how Southern Oregon is, it's kind of a narrow valleys everywhere, like the Applegate Valley, the Illinois Valley, the Rogue Valley, which are all kind of technically a part of the Rogue Basin. Most, you maybe have like a mile or two across the valley before you're like bumping into your neighbor. And so considering the USDA themselves were like, well, we mandate by law, you must keep, Syngenta had to keep the 4-mile distance. And here they were plotted all across Southern Oregon. And we're like, wait a minute, that means that the seeds that we're saving are likely getting contaminated by these guys. And so how did they get away with it? I don't know. That's for the record book. And it's all in our lawsuit. It was basically just BS. It was nonsense that the USDA sent in a couple attorneys out and did an investigation. They found no wrongdoing and they dismissed it. Like, how could you dismiss it when they're basically running people into potential that the company would sue farmers for saving seeds that got contaminated by genetically engineered by their technology, which is by law, against the law, to be able to save those seeds, sell those seeds, or replant those seeds. So I was a part of that initial effort, and I was the chief petitioner of the Jackson County GMO crop ban. And May of 2014, 66% of Jackson County said no to GMOs, yes to family farms, and 58% of Josephine County said the same. And so we thereby sent any of the Monsanto GMO corn that was being grown here, GMO sugar beets, we sent all the GMO anything out of our valley. And that's what happened back in 2014, 2012, 2013, 2014, that took up so much, citizens and people's efforts and time and energy. And we had hundreds of farmers that supported that crop ban. And it was just rallying. It was all about rallying the citizens around what the needs of the farmers were. And on that day, in that campaign, the farmers of this valley spoke and they said, this is what we need in order to continue to farm here. And so we did that to protect the future of local agriculture here in the valley. Super important. And so Jackson County was then sued by Monsanto and backed by their money and a couple farmers who were like, oh, well, we want to grow GMOs. And so anyhow, they lost that lawsuit. We won the lawsuit. They sued Jackson County saying, hey, you guys can't do this. Every farmer has the right to farm. Do whatever they want. And we're like, yeah, the right to farm, not to harm the economic livelihoods of other farmers. To say nothing of the fact that these use so many different herbicides and pesticides and chemicals. We're like, man, this is impactful on children. We don't want that stuff. We don't want, you know, what GMOs stand for. Again, as I shared earlier, 20, 25 years of growing genetically engineered crops, the best we could come up with, Sarah, 95% of all that is it either makes its own pesticide or it's designed to be sprayed with herbicides. So it's like, wow, is that really? I thought they were doing something that like improved the nutrition. It's like, no. If anything, it's gone downhill and they're taking that material now and putting it into ethanol production because it's so high in sugar and they're making gasoline out of it. And we're seeing more, like there's supposedly an uptick of the amount of ethanol that's being produced. And we're like, supposedly there's like massive losses of crops this year because of the climate and farmers are growing soybeans or corn. You know, that's like, welcome to America. And so that's just the part of the broken system. And we did not want to sign up for being a part of that broken system.
Well, thank you so much for all your hours, days, years of life that you put into that, because as a result of that, we don't have GMO crops here, which is amazing. That is amazing. And I'm curious if you do have any tips for folks who might be interested in leading something similar in their local regions.
Yeah, there. I could send off like the petition, the ordinance in Jackson County that was passed under the ballot measure 15-119. They could for surely search on the internet and find Jackson County, Oregon GMO crop ban, and they would type in 15-119, and there's like a ballotpedia.com. They like look at different ballot measures. I know that that's still out there on the web to learn more about that. They could send me an email and I could send a copy of the ordinance that we have on the books in Jackson County. It's officially on the books in Jackson County, but it's complicated because of the lawsuit. And so the lawsuit will end in about 1 year in 2023. I will be able to like send anybody an email with the link to Jackson County's website that will take them directly to our ordinance. But at this time, they say that they cannot make it on their website because of this lawsuit, which is going to be complete, of which we won. I should say we won the lawsuit. And in case I didn't already mention that. So we beat Monsanto 3 times here in Southern Oregon, like really freaking amazing David and Goliath battle that the citizens of our valley fought and won. And Josephine County got sued. And so their ordinance is kind of on shaky ground. It's currently, we got to go to Salem to ask for the state to undo the Monsanto Protection Act of the state of Oregon in order for Josephine County and any other county in the whole state to be able to do what Jackson County did, which is not only get it approved by the citizens at the ballot, but also, you know, if we're a lawsuit were to come about, to not have it be like, oh, well, the state of Oregon says that you can't do this. And really, it was just a bunch of Monsanto money that came in and paid off all these politicians to basically pass legislation that said, every county in the Oregon, state of Oregon, except Jackson County, cannot ban GMOs. And so that's like what happened back in 2012 and 2013. Like that, just the funny business, just the total nonsense. But I'm happy to send via email, or you will have my contact that I can get that to anybody who wants that. And then also Mendocino County, Sonoma County, Trinity County in California, Humboldt County, California, Santa Cruz County, and I think that's six counties in California: Trinity, Humboldt, Mendocino, Sonoma, Santa Cruz, and yeah, I think that's it. And then San Juan Islands in Washington State, also the county of San Juan County in Washington State also banned GMO crops. So I think in total, that is like nine counties in the whole U.S. have GMO crop bans in place. But we are the only one in the state of Oregon, officially.
Well, thank you again for all of your work with that and for offering to connect with people directly. And the work that you do is incredible. And so please tell us, how can people find out more about Hardy Seeds and your work?
Well, they could go visit our website, which we're hoping to have updated. It hasn't been updated in like a year, but what's on the website is current as far as our stock and availability. But they could go to growhardyseeds.com and see what we have available. And as far as the grain seed library, some of those grains we've been growing for a number of years, some of those grains will be available on our website as well. But for the most part, the grain library, people could just send me an email at growhardyseeds@gmail.com. And I'd be happy to connect, get people seed if they need some seed and want to return some of the seed back to our seed libraries. We're asking for 15 to 20% of the seed returned back so that we can ensure that the seed library has more seed for other growers, not only here for local, but for beyond local.
Amazing. Well, Chris, thank you so much for that. Just really thinking forward into that collaborative, mycelial kind of way with the seeds, how important that is. And so thank you so much for all of your work here in Southern Oregon, for your work with the seeds, with the food crops, for your life's work with the plants, and for joining us here today on the Plants for Your podcast. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah, sure, Sarah. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate that.
And thanks so much for listening and joining us today on the Plant Spirit podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, and please follow to subscribe, leave a review, and look forward to seeing you on the next episode.